Hello and welcome to a special edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. Today, for an article we recently reviewed, we talk with the lead investigator of the study so that we can understand a little more about how this type of research is conducted and hear her thoughts on questions we raised during our initial discussion. If you have not done so already, I recommend that you listen to episode 15 entitled Hypoglycemia After Gastric Bypass, in which we review the August 2021 JCENM paper, Glycemic Patterns Are Distinct in Post-Bariatric Hypoglycemia After Gastric Bypass. Joining me today is the senior author of that paper, Mary Elizabeth Patty. Among many roles, she directs the hypoglycemia clinic at the Joslin Diabetes Center at Harvard. She has numerous publications and presentations in diabetes and hypoglycemia, particularly in post-bariatric surgery hypoglycemia. I would add that she is considered one of, if not the world's experts in this condition. So we're delighted to get the chance to speak with her today. Mary Elizabeth, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And where I wanted to start with, we'll eventually get into the particulars of this specific investigation that you did and chat about that a little bit more, but I thought it would be great for our listeners to hear just a little bit more. You do numerous research studies, numerous different types of research studies, but particularly with the clinical studies that you do, those ones that are driven by the patients that you see, we thought it'd be very insightful to hear from you. Kind of walk us through that process. If you want, you could use this particular study as an example, or just speak in general about how do you initially come up with these questions. So when you're seeing patients and you realize that you're encountering scenarios that are not answered, or at least not answered well with the existing medical literature, how do you start developing those questions that you eventually end up exploring?
Well, thanks for that question. When I see patients, my brain is constantly trying to understand what is it that we don't understand about this condition that patients have. And if that information is lacking, it often impacts the ability to treat those patients as optimally as we can. And so understanding more about the pathophysiology of a specific condition that's critical for patients really should stimulate all of us to try to ask, what information can we learn from patients in order to improve our diagnostic approach and our treatment options? So those are kind of the thoughts that I have. And, you know, as I see a lot of patients, for example, with post-bariatric hypoglycemia, I'm always thinking about what is the common feature of many of these patients and what are the key questions that are really important to ask that would improve their care.
That's helpful. So then as a follow-up question, because I think, probably a lot of us ask or wonder those types of questions. But I think a big thing that makes you distinct and folks who do clinical investigation like you is you take that next step. So it's not just initial question that you wonder about, but then you actually turn that into a research study that begins to answer those questions. And that's a huge topic and a lot to cover there. But at least at a high level, how do you start making that transition? So how do you go from a question that comes from seeing a patient or several patients and then actually turn that into an investigation that yields important results like what you've done so frequently?
Well, I think this condition, post-bariatric hypoglycemia, is a good example. We really started with some case reports where we had seen some very challenging patients and found a number of patients that shared common pathophysiology and wrote case reports about that. And then the next step is, well, what are the questions that I might be able to address during my clinical evaluation that would also give us clues about pathophysiology? So over the years, our studies have really evolved from case report to simple interventions like mixed meal tolerance tests with hormonal analyses, up to what we're doing now, which is really a multi-pronged analysis, which includes genetic analysis, hormonal response to meals, hormonal responses to hypoglycemia, analysis of contribution of the gut microbiome and other metabolic processes. So it really started with a clinical question, but has now expanded to encompass many aspects of pathophysiology. And I think you really just need to go where the patient questions are driving you and where the data that you accumulate drive you. And it becomes a natural progression over time.
That's helpful. And so another question that I had, and in particular, we've reviewed many different types of articles on our podcast. Most of them, though, are observational studies. And I know you do a combination, some clinical trials, some observational studies. But we find in particular, and this is true throughout the medical literature, that observational studies, they're great for some things, but they have a bunch of intrinsic limitations that you've just got to deal with and can sometimes be pretty challenging to do that. So how do you think about that? Because we'll get into this in more particulars with this paper. But how do you think about that in general when you've got this data? So maybe you've seen a bunch of patients, you have some form of a database or at least a lot of data that you can access with the patients that you've seen. How do you start thinking about wrestling with these different intrinsic challenges when you begin that process of designing a study?
The first step is to acknowledge that observational studies in humans are intrinsically limited. But sometimes that's all you can do. We can't be doing invasive biopsies or other things always to address a metabolic problem, especially, for example. When appropriate, and if someone has the resources or collaborations, then one may want to consider a parallel animal study to get additional information that can't be obtained from an observational type human study. So that's always something to think about pretty early. You know, maybe I should in parallel look at an animal model where I can really ask some questions that I can't address in humans. But sometimes that's not always realistic. If you think of the perspective of the practicing clinician, just because data are observational doesn't mean they're not valuable. And you just have to acknowledge that they may not show cause and effect. They may not completely solve the pathophysiologic puzzle that you'd like to solve, but each bit of observational data builds on a theme that allows you to ask more probing questions, which ultimately may lead you to the pathophysiology and allow you to test those. So observational data are absolutely limited, but can still be helpful in the grand scheme of understanding a disease and allow you to build a mass of data, which can help you manage patients clinically and help you understand the specific disease.
That's a perfect segue then to the last question that I wanted to ask in this initial part, which is trying to understand when you've accumulated enough of that information to where you think that you could advocate for a change in clinical practice. On the podcast, that's something that we always wrestle with, that we try to end every episode with asking that question is, does this article give us enough information to change our clinical practice as it is right now? But give us some insight on that from the perspective of an investigator. When you're trying to decide as you're summarizing your own findings here and in any type of paper, is how do you decide, okay, good, this was a good start, but I think probably other authors and other situations need to replicate this or do different types of studies before we can really make changes? Or how can you go all the way and say, I don't know, I think this is pretty convincing. I think we actually need to start changing our clinical practice based on that. So when you come to that part of, say, writing up your findings and in that part of the discussion, how do you make that decision as you're sorting through that information?
Well, that's always tough. You'd always like to be able to solve the problem 100% before publishing anything. But that takes years of research studies with different components. So you want to put out data that may build on the general knowledge base about a specific condition and may help clinicians, even if it doesn't solve the problem completely. And I would say for this study in particular, we certainly acknowledge that it's an observational set of data about continuous glucose monitoring. And I want to emphasize that continuous glucose monitoring data are limited. They're not sufficiently accurate for diagnosis. However, the thing that made me want to publish this limited data set was that I wanted to convey the message to clinicians that people who have post-bariatric hypoglycemia can have some nocturnal hypoglycemia. And I would say that was my driving reason to publish these data, because I want clinicians who take care of patients, and there are many people who know the challenges of this patient population, but it's important to understand that nocturnal hypoglycemia can be present And that's not the same as fasting hypoglycemia. But it really should be a call for clinicians to ask their patients about symptoms of nocturnal hypoglycemia. Because if the perception is that it's entirely a postprandial disease, the clinician and the patient alike may not discuss the possibility that indeed hypoglycemia can occur in the middle of the night, in response to exercise, or at other times of the day. And so that was really my goal, was to just provide some very basic clinical information to alert to that possibility about nocturnal hypoglycemia.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary as we transition to thinking a little bit more about this specific work that you did. Yeah, we were interested from the very beginning. I think it was very obvious to us as we looked through all of the articles that have been recently published in one of the Endocrine Society journals, and that this one very obviously stood out as one that extremely well done and had very important information that our listeners needed to know for the care that they provide, because one, it is an increasingly frequent scenario that we're encountering, and one that we don't understand very much about and don't really know what to do about in many situations. So yeah, all those reasons, it jumped out right away as, wow, this is definitely an article that we want to talk about, because there was some important information that was uncovered here. And it really did. So just as a quick recap for our listeners, in case it's been a little while since you listened to that episode in particular, is that they did take a group of individuals who had reported having hypoglycemia after they had undergone bariatric surgery, and did a blinded continuous glucose monitoring for these individuals, and then reported on that pattern with, just as Mary Elizabeth said, identified that a fairly unrecognized component of this overnight lows may be an issue based on the CGM findings that were there.
Let me just back up one second and make the point that the mean glucose from this particular study in the overnight hours, the mean sensor glucose, was not at hypoglycemic levels. What I want to emphasize is that the patterns are what we're looking at. The glucose levels can drop during nocturnal hours based on the sensor glucose data. And that's a big limitation, because sensor glucose is not the same as venous glucose. Number one, we all know that there are inaccuracies that can be accentuated in the nocturnal hours, for example, with compression of the sensor during sleep can give falsely low sensor glucose values. We're not really finding across this population, the sensor glucose values themselves were not on average dangerous level, but the pattern is that glucose levels do drop, and some individual patients have very low sensor glucoses overnight. So just to clarify that.
Yes, and thank you. That's an excellent and helpful clarification there. So one of the questions that we were curious about, and again, I think this goes back to that previous question of how do you deal with the observational data, was when you chose a comparison group. So you took folks from other studies where they had used continuous glucose monitoring, and that was folks who had not had gastric bypass, didn't have a history of known hypoglycemia, and looked at those patterns on a CGM and compared them to your folks who had reported hypoglycemia after their weight loss surgery. So kind of how was that decision made? Because I think one of the questions was raised as well, could it have actually been a comparison to individuals who had weight loss surgery, but at least were unaware of or didn't report a history of hypoglycemia? So, and I know you guys wrestled with that and thought through how that could be done. So how did you end up with the decision that you ended up making there as far as choosing a comparison group?
Well, we certainly sometimes have to make choices based on available data, just from a practical perspective. And I certainly agree that the best comparison group are people who've had gastric bypass who do not have documented or reported symptoms of hypoglycemia. And in fact, we have a current NIH-funded study where we are evaluating that control group exactly for that reason. And that's where we have to balance practicality and study design. So for example, right now we're looking at healthy individuals, patients with post-bariatric documented hypoglycemia, and post-bariatric patients who do not have hypoglycemia. And that's the appropriate set of comparison groups, I think. But the data that we reported in this manuscript were really clinical data. And I don't see patients who don't have hypoglycemia, so those data weren't available. Once we received funding to do research to really recruit those patients without hypoglycemia who had bariatric surgery, then we could answer that question. And that's an ongoing study right now.
Yeah, so we'll look forward to hearing more about that, and it could easily be another episode in a future edition of our podcast. And so I think that also really nicely illustrates the point you were making earlier, is that natural progression of studies, is that initially it's just case reports, there is no comparison there, and then it progresses, and that this is just the natural progression of continuing to find out more and more and more about these groups as you continue to do this investigation. So another couple of questions. So one of them you mentioned already is that the point of your findings, or the main emphasis, was not necessarily on the absolute value given the potential limitations of the accuracy of CGM in other populations such as the ones that you studied, but that the patterns were really the important thing to recognize there. We had other couple of questions though related to the interpretation there, and those were around not knowing for sure whether individuals were symptomatic or asymptomatic if they had sugars that were reported as low on that CGM, and also some unknown questions about timing of eating, whether this was a fasting overnight or if actually there was food and maybe this was a postprandial phenomena, even if it did occur in the middle of the night. So what are your thoughts on that? I know you guys wrestled with that, thought through a lot of that. And what are your thoughts on that information as far as interpreting the results that you discovered?
Well, that's a major limitation of these observational data sets. I can assure you that when we do blinded continuous glucose monitoring on all of our patients, we ask them to complete a diary with food, symptoms, and the timing. But as you know, that's not always successful. And despite our best efforts, we have incomplete data sets. So that type of information is really critical to allow you to determine the relationship between those symptoms and what's happening with the sensor glucose patterns. So I would have loved to have been able to include that information because it is really important. Just because a glucose level is low or low normal doesn't mean that it's abnormal if the patient's not having symptoms. On the contrary, though, we also have to acknowledge that there are many of these patients who have post-bariatric hypoglycemia that's been documented who develop unawareness. So just like a patient with type 1 diabetes who has frequent hypoglycemia becomes unaware, same thing can happen in patients who have post-bariatric hypoglycemia. So I think the take-home message that I would like to convey is that patterns indicating that sensor glucose levels drop after meals, after activity, and in the middle of the night can be observed clinically. There are many factors that could contribute to those patterns, and ideally, you'd want to make a strong link to symptoms that they're having, but not always possible, and some people actually have hypoglycemia unawareness as well. So those are the factors that we should be thinking about when interpreting the information.
And then this has been incredibly helpful for us to hear and understand from somebody who does this work, who is an expert, not just clinically in this field, but also on the cutting edge of doing this research to understand what is going on with these patients that we so often struggle with knowing what to do for them. So it's been great for you to give us more insight there and a look under the hood, if you will, as far as how you actually do these studies and come up with this important information. And we look forward to continuing to hear more and more out of your group that I think will continue to push this field forward and actually give us the tools that we need to take care of these patients. Anything else, though, before we wrap up today that you would like us to know or hear about your work or things that we can look forward to in the future coming from your study group?
I guess I would just advocate for clinicians who take care of these patients to consider using CGM in patients with unawareness where safety is an issue. So it's very challenging to get CGM covered for this population because they don't have diabetes and they're not being treated with insulin. But nevertheless, they're facing safety issues they're similar to patients with diabetes. And so I would really advocate clinicians to think about CGM and really work hard to try to get coverage for their patients, as difficult as it is. And I'm very familiar with these challenges. And I would hope that at some point in the future, we would be successful in expanding coverage as well. But think about CGM in patients, especially with unawareness.
And with that, I would like to thank Mary Elizabeth Patti for joining me for this special edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a lot, as I know you all as our listeners did, and hope that you will each join us again for our next episode. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.